You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
So many players, but too many pawns. Too many judges say what's right or wrong. Let them jump into the fire if they want to play.
And welcome to ESO Pro, the Pro Wrestling Roundtable. Today we are looking back to the November tradition, the Thanksgiving tradition, to be more accurate, from early on.
Starcade?
No, the other one. Survivor Series. The one that us Northerners liked for some reason.
the one that's still around.
However, we're looking back at the history of 4-on-4 and 5-on-5, depending on the year. Those are both traditional Survivor Series matches. Math has never been the strong suit of WWE, in case anyone is wondering. But yeah, we're going to take a look back at a lot of the past Survivor Series matches, and we might even discuss a certain big-time Survivor Series match of this year as well. There's only one on the epically deep three-match card currently sitting for Survivor Series in just about a week from when we're recording this. So there might be another. We'll see. I doubt it. Anyway.
The people.
Joined today, as always, by Mr. Alex Autry.
Hey.
And John Morgan Neal.
Greetings and salutations.
And a special guest to talk Survivor Series.
Because we had to have a fourth person.
Yeah, and beards from the sound of it. Lots of beards. Yeah. Mr. Mike Gordon, how's it going, Mike?
Howdy.
Yay!
A pleasure to join you in the squared circle.
Yes, of a round table, which is...
Of a round table.
Just to be confusing.
A round table in the squared circle.
Right. Oh, that makes much more sense.
You don't use round tables in a squared circle. You can't put people through those easily.
So. Oh, sure you can. There's more chairs around them, too.
No, that's true. The chairs do help. Sure, don't get me wrong.
Yeah. All right.
And it's on Free Bird Road. That's it.
We don't have to drink for Free Bird references, just and Texas references, right?
No.
Okay.
No.
Because I have to go to work later on tonight. So.
Well, you know.
Anyway, let's talk some Survivor Series, and why don't we start with this year's Survivor Series match? Of course, it is Team Cena versus Team Authority in the main event of the 2014 Survivor Series, with the John Cena-captained Team Cena, no one saw that coming, with its members of Dolph Ziggler, Sheamus, Big Show, and some other guy that's all admit would just be Ryback. And of course, Team Authority with Seth Rollins, Corporate Kane, because that's apparently his full name now. Don't let me get that wrong. Rusev, Mark Henry, and Luke Harper looks like would be our fifth member of that team, formerly of the Wyatt family. So what does everyone think about this match? Let's open it up. I'm liking it, so what's everyone else think?
Let's ask Mike. Mike's the guest. Mike goes first.
Well, it seems like they've really loosely put this together. They have a little over a week now to get this really set in our minds to be excited for it. I like all the people involved. But I got to admit, I'm not excited about the actual match itself, the actual matchups. I'm kind of curious as to how they arrange this. I mean, obviously, they need, you know, something for Cena to do since there's not a championship match. Again, it's almost like they forgot they have a belt.
Have you seen the thing? It's ugly. I don't blame them.
You know, it would be kind of cool, just as a gesture, you know, if at some point Brock shows up, you know, like just to destroy somebody, just the at whim. But in any case, and the stakes in this, I guess Vince came out and said that if Authority doesn't win, they are no longer going to be in Authority.
Right.
But what's in it besides that? Is there anything in it for Cena's team? Or is
no,
that just enough?
It's
they just don't like the Authority.
It's yeah, they don't don't like the. I don't know. I look at this, and the thing is that there's so many great wrestlers. Okay, there are a couple of great. Okay, where is Cesaro? That's what I'm going to ask. Cesaro, Big E Langston, Kofi Kingston. If you look at Team Cena's team, Ziggler, Big Show, Sheamus, Ryback, how many of them were heels in the last year, year and a half? And this is the team that Cena puts together. Cena doesn't go to the fan favorites, the good guys who have been around this entire time, to build up his team. And I think the whole thing just kind of looks bad, in my opinion. There's not a whole lot. Considering the fact that the Survivor Series is being basically given away for free this year, I don't think they're loading it up.
Hey, I'm paying $9.99 a month for it. So
that's only because you and me and the rest of us were not dumb enough to cancel our subscriptions to resubscribe.
Very true.
That's true. I should have done that.
That's because you could do that. You could have done that. You didn't even have to skip one. You could cancel your account today and start it again tomorrow, and you get the month of November for free.
Excuse me. Let me get on the phone just now.
I know, right? Those of you who are listening right now, we'll wait.
Press pause right now.
I also think that putting Rusev in here is a bad move. I think they're doing a really good push with him, and putting him on this team, I don't think works at all.
It guarantees there will be at least one count out or disqualification removal of probably wrestlers in this match. That's what it means, because Rusev is not losing with 1-2-3 pin, so that means he either is counted out or he is disqualified for attacking someone.
Could be disqualified for refusing to let go of the hold. Could be something like that, which would be a great way to wear down John Cena.
Yeah. Cena could eliminate each other and set up the feud that's going to come after this next month's pay-per-view, too.
Yeah.
When I look at Team Authority, I'm looking at Seth Rollins, who's uber hot right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Kane, who's just, I mean, God bless him, he's a workhorse, but he's irrelevant. Mark
bless
Henry,
his heart, I believe is the phrase we're looking for.
Mark Henry is irrelevant. Rusev is hot, but and Luke is just kind of thrown in there. So I don't like this sort of that team at all either. It really just speaks of being thrown together.
Is
Orton hurt? What's up with him?
He's filming a movie.
Yeah, he's filming a movie. That's why he's seriously injured by a cinder block. Not a cinder block, a curb stomp to a step.
Sorry. Gotcha.
Wrong curb stomp. He may pop up by the end of the show, but we'll see. I don't think he'll be back for Survivor Series. I think he'll be back right after Survivor Series. But, to continue his feud with Seth Rollins. But I think going in that what has happened to this match is what started to seem like they were actually building teams became, hey, we have all of these feuds that aren't necessarily something that are going to be big pay-per-view matches, so let's put all those feuds together into one five-on-five match. Right down to setting up Ryback versus Kane, as a feud. To have an excuse for Ryback versus Kane to be in this match.
It's not even a feud, it's an argument.
Yes. I think this match is going to end up being a showcase for Ryback and Luke Harper and for whoever on Team Cena ends up turning and joining Team Authority to give Team Authority the win. I think those are going to be the highlights of the match. Although Seth Rollins probably will curb stomp at least one person, and that is always awesome. So
That's Dolph.
Sadly, yeah, it's going to be Dolph.
Well, unless Dolph is the guy who turns, so.
No.
My guess is Dolph is the guy that turns simply because he's the guy that's been berated most by Triple H as not being worth it.
That's a good point.
Yeah, that is a good point. I think maybe, but then Dolph's like really the only one of the only really great faces that they have now, though.
Yeah,
they have.
I would kind of, you know, hate that them to lose that. I could see Sheamus turning before maybe Dolph.
Sheamus is my choice, but I don't know if he would turn. So.
And in real life, Sheamus and Triple H are buddies, so
it's true.
Could be, but motivation there as well. We're going to work with Triple H, but
as the face of their anti-bullying campaign,
yeah, this thing is makeshift on both sides, and there's also some that definitely would be better fits in there that I don't understand. I mean, they could have held off the heat, and actually, like you said, it seems like they are kind of not building a lot of heat for Bray and Dean. Why isn't Dean in this match? And then nobody hates Ambrose and Authority more than he does.
Yeah.
So why wouldn't he be involved in the one side of it? You know, you could even
so they can have one big singles match.
I guess, yeah. but it's just unfortunately indicated for the last several years of the Survivor Series of makeshift teams that just don't fit together like a beautiful puzzle piece or anything. It's just,
right.
You know, not good.
Yeah. One of my big complaints actually in this match is that John Cena's good person of friends, as established for months and months heading into this match, who also have had history with the Authority, the Usos are absolutely nowhere to be seen.
Yeah, good point.
Having the Usos with Cena would be a great idea.
Yeah, why they were not two of the five members of this team, I still don't understand. When they first, even if they were going to be the sacrificial lambs that Jack Swagger ended up being this week of the I'm the guy that's going to get beat up and sent out on a concussion, I would have been fine with that. But the fact that the Usos have just kind of been like, John Cena who? Going into this pay-per-view seems really weird because, again, they're like buddy buddies. Those are his friends. As established in the last year of television, Cena and the Usos, woo, would go way back for reasons no one quite understands. But, nowhere to be found.
Oh.
And the Usos have been, to me, one of the highlights of the past few pay-per-views. Their matches are always solid.
Absolutely.
And having Luke Harper in the ring with the Usos again in and of itself will just mean something good, I'm pretty sure. Because those Wyatt-Uso matches they did for about three straight months there were just the best things on.
They were good. They were the best
things If you take Luke and Eric, take Rusev out, put Luke and Eric and then have the Usos on the other side, then I'm really interested in this. Yeah.
It definitely ups the work rate of the match, yeah.
Yeah.
All right, so mixed feelings on our free pay-per-view main event coming up. By the way, does not really make it a pay-per-view. Just want to throw that out. So,
well, it'll be a pay-per-view when the commentators point out that those dummies who bought it on pay-per-view could have gotten it for free this month.
Yes, like not even that's free. Are you an idiot? We noticed if you watched this week's Raw, you had no mentions of that whatsoever doing the extra show, however, because they're in the UK where they stood.
They don't quite have it yet.
Well, let's look back now after talking about one big Survivor Series match of today to the past. Let's open it up. Let's start from the beginning. And then we're to kind of go forward and talk about other Survivor Series matches that are of interest to us. Of course, this started way back in 1987, back when I was 9 years old, and everyone else here was older, maybe? I don't know.
Yep.
You guys are all...
I was 16 years old.
That's what I want to establish. You're all alone.
I had just graduated.
I was 16.
I was a freshman in college.
Nice.
Fair enough.
No, sorry. November, I'm actually a sophomore in college.
Fair enough.
So I'm not watching this, sorry.
fair enough, too. The main event was Team Hogan versus Team Andre, which I think just cements the date of this pay-per-view exactly.
Yeah, but you know what? It was like what Mike was saying earlier, with one of the problems with this year's was that it feels very thrown together. This main event, this team up right here of Andre's team versus Hogan's team, totally the opposite. Did not feel thrown together at all.
This must have felt like a dream team. Like, really?
Yeah, it really
was. And I was 24, by the way. But anyway, that's exactly right.
For those
right.
playing at home, John Morgan is 147 years old.
Yes, I am. But this thing natural. It seemed correct that these particular groups would go up against each other, with the mm-hmm. Captains being Andre and then Hogan.
Yeah, but yeah, I mean, when you look at it,
Bigelow and Rick Rude to up the work rate of everyone else in the match. So,
and holy cow, was Bigelow the MVP of that match or what?
Yes, he was.
This was one of those rare instances with the WWF, especially at that time, where the end of the pay-per-view had the bad guys winning,
mm-hmm.
Which was so cool because Andre's team won. They had eliminated just about everybody, and Bam Bam suddenly has his breakout moment. He had just joined the WWF no less than 5-6 months earlier, and they had done this whole thing where it's like, oh, we're looking to who's going to be the manager of Bam Bam Bigelow, and out comes Oliver Humperdinck, and Bam Bam is suddenly a fan favorite,
mm-hmm.
Which is confusing for those of us who had known Oliver Humperdinck. Yeah, this one was really cool. This was the work rate, obviously very, very, it's Andre and Hogan, sadly, in both of their primes with a dash of King Kong Bundy and the One Man Gang.
Yes.
And
those are the other three final survivors of the final four.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah.
The final 4 minutes, by the way, I believe was a 6 minute window between Hogan's elimination and Bam Bam Bigelow's final elimination by Andre the Giant, the sole survivor. So there was definitely a let's hurry this up now that Hogan's out of the match kind of feel to it. But.
Yeah, but it was still it was one of those things where you could kind of sit there and say, man, maybe Bigelow's going to do it, Maybe Bigelow's going to be the man. And then no.
Andre gets the W in the match. But it's basically on one of Andre's last major moments in WWE.
Yeah.
It's this big heel top run. I want to point out my favorite match from that first four match Survivor Series card, which is, of course, the team of Team Sherry, Sensation Sherry, the Glamour Girls, Donna Cristianello, and Dawn Marie, not the ECW lady, versus Team Moolah of Fabulous Moolah, Rockin' Robert, Velvet McIntyre, and the Jumping Bomb Angels, with Moolah's team as the faces, by the way. Dates this as a little later in the classic WWE era, but yeah, very competitive women's match. Probably one of the first really early, long, competitive women's matches on WWE TV, and really showed that someone booking at WWE was really in love with the Jumping Bomb Angels at the time, because they got to come out of this thing looking like $1 million as the two survivors of the match. But very, very strong match. A very hard push for the short-lived women's tag team division in this match, too. But
I think it lasted as long as this match.
Well, no. The Glamour Girls and the Bangles went around. I remember vividly. I was loving it. I mean, I've always loved the women's division, and I loved it when it's going well. And I was really digging the tag team feud between them. But it was a great match. It really was. There's some good couple of veterans there, and the Jumping Bomb Angels coming over. They're still really new. But the real star of that match is Sherry, because doing her thing like she does, like nobody else, really was the anchor of the heel team and made the Jumping Bomb Angels look as good as they did. Sherry gets talked about a lot, and usually mostly it's focused on her managing, which was great. I mean, that's there's a reason for that, but her wrestling career doesn't get talked about as much as since she had been a great manager, and it's a shame because she really was damn good, and she was as a matter of fact, I think it's one of those situations where the female wrestling pretty much died, pretty soon after this, and it's a shame because they had a great star like Sherry that they could have built that thing around. They were building it around, but for some reason they decided just to give up on it. And I don't know why, because it's a shame because Sherry, I think, would be more of a legend as a wrestler if that wasn't for the case. Because
I personally feel it's more of a testament to just how good she was as a manager.
Well,
nobody remembers Bobby Heenan as a wrestler. True. But everybody remembers Heenan as a manager. And I think, in my opinion, yes, Sherry was great in the ring. She was better, in my opinion, outside it. And that's not an insult on her in-ring ability. That's a praise of how good she was outside.
Sure. I'm 100% with you on that. You know, I mean, yeah. she was more than just one, you know, she had more than one facet. Yeah, exactly. She's one of the great talents of all time. And she made everybody she was with way, way better. And as a, because she was good in the ring, she was able to do stuff outside of the ring and that was very, especially usual for a female wrestler, valet or whatever, because she was vicious and she would attack the guys in the ring. But anyway, yeah, this was a great match and there was some great talent in it and I really enjoyed it.
I would just point out to everyone listening, if you head over to the ESO Pro Facebook group, I have this match posted up conveniently for anyone who wants to watch it. So join us on Facebook.
But as much as I love this match, it's not my favorite of the four.
Oh, then John Morganier, what is your favorite Survivor Series match?
My favorite Survivor Series match was indicative. It was probably one of the greatest examples of just how prevalent and how big tag team wrestling was in the 80s, because they had not one, not five, not 10, but a 20-man tag team Survivor Series elimination match. With just about every tag team that they had in all of WWE at the time, which is, you know.
I think they were short the Conquistadors. And
no, they were there. Conquistadors.
Possibly. Oh, you're right. They were, weren't they?
Yeah, they were. Yes.
That's hysterical. Yeah. Okay, probably the team of Steve Lombardi and Iron Mike Sharp.
No, they weren't in.
Iron Mike Sharp wasn't regularly working for them yet. Don't be silly.
But yeah, so I mean, you know, both in the NWA and in WWE, you know, tag team was the thing of the day, and I loved it because the tag team wrestling is my absolute favorite type of wrestling. In fact, yeah. I'm a Freebird fan, and Edge and Christian fan should say about that. But anyway. This was just like amazing. I just couldn't believe it. It's like, you know, all the tag team guys were all in the match and, you know, you had and great tag teams too. I mean, the Brainbusters were there and it just was a really, really awesome match.
Yeah, I was very surprised.
The Conquistadors match, by the way, was 98, not 90, or 88, not 87.
I was very surprised to see, because it's been a while, that everything on the card is a Survivor Series elimination match, which I was like,
it's a small card though.
Well, it is, but I mean, when you've got so many people in each match, I mean, you can do that. I mean, each one of the matches went like 20, 30 minutes. So
the shortest match was the women's match at 20 minutes. Yeah.
So, whereas, you know, it's not until 91 where they actually have the first singles match ever in a Survivor Series event. So I was kind of surprised that it lasted that long where the card was completely made up of, you know, 5-on-5, 4-on-4s, or tag teams.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, of course, I believe 91 was also the last time it was a Thanksgiving night tradition as opposed to a November Sunday November tradition. The first 5 years, I believe. The show ran on Thanksgiving night as a pay-per-view, which you wouldn't think there'd be a lot of people sitting at home after eating turkey that wanted to watch WWE pay-per-views, and maybe there wasn't, and that's why it became a Sunday pay-per-view.
I was going to say, there's a reason that it moved.
Yeah.
Quite possibly.
It might have been a lot of a problem of getting people coming to the arena on Thanksgiving night.
I did notice, according to the Wikipedia anyway, the attendance did drop after that first one. It was held at the same place. In 87, the first one, the attendance was 21,300 in Richfield Coliseum in Richfield, Ohio. And in the second year, 88, it happened at the same exact city, but the attendance was 13,500.
Yeah,
so there's a pretty big drop right there. So.
Well, the Red Rooster was in the main event of the second one, so that makes sense.
Um,
Go ahead.
This is a pay-per-view that really does kind of fluctuate with the crowds. I mean, the largest crowd for any of these shows is the 98 one, for which was the World Championship Tournament, which happens to be my favorite of all the Survivor Series. Survivor Series, I guess. And that one is 21,700. So yeah, it's just barely over the first one. But right. Yeah, there are shows where like the attendance drops down to 7,000-8,000 people, which is kind of crazy when you think this is a pay-per-view, you know.
Well, you got to keep in mind
and some of that. And a signature pay-per-view at that.
Some of that is the fluctuation of typical crowds that were just going to Survivor to WWE shows, let alone Survivor Series. Excuse me. So that is going to make some level of difference. But yeah, there's definitely some of these, especially early on, and I think the reason why by 91 they were starting to break from the format was because with nothing really at stake in Survivor Series matches except saying our team beat your team, it became they needed more to make people want to foist out the $29.95 or $24.95 that pay-per-views were at the time.
Yeah.
I would imagine, meanwhile, though, if you're on the roster of the WWF, you're pretty excited because you know at least there's one time a year where you're probably going to get some airtime.
Yeah, that's there's right. A chance at a paycheck on in Thanksgiving time.
Exactly. I want to reiterate, Red Rooster was in the main event of a Survivor Series, so I rest my case.
Talk a little doo.
If you're sitting in the locker room all night at Survivor Series, you've seriously done something wrong.
You know, I refute that. Yes, it was a ridiculous gimmick. Yes, it was a terrible part of Terry Taylor's life. But it wasn't like Terry Taylor wasn't, a top mid-card heel. He wasn't just some jobber jabroni who was lucky to be out there. Thank you.
That is true.
The man had a T-shirt that said Poultry in Motion.
Also true.
Hey, I'm just saying. It's that he was getting a push. So
yeah, right out the door.
Eventually, yeah.
I feel bad for Terry. I love Terry.
I was a huge fan of Terry Taylor. He was in World Class right before he went there and mm-hmm. doing great heel work and so forth. And UWF, you know, he was doing great there. And the thing is that Terry was a really, really good hand and had a particular style and thing. But it's funny because I just this week was listening to a bit of your kayfabe commentaries bit with Brother Love Bruce Pritchard. Bruce Pritchard. He was behind the scenes then, and he was defending all of that, all of those gimmicks like that, and Bastion Booger and all this and the other, and it was amazing. He was just straight-facedly defending it, and he was explaining that, well, Terry Taylor was sort of just bland, vanilla, you know, doing the Red Rooster thing, you know, just made him a little more interesting. And it was like, it was so funny. You could tell Terry Taylor would smack him in the mouth if he could have been in the same room. But the thing is that, you know, he was blaming the whole thing on Terry Taylor, that it was Terry Taylor who didn't embrace it and run with it and make it work for him like others have other bad gimmicks and whatever. So anyway.
Okay.
Yeah.
He's wrong, but we'll move on.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He's totally wrong. But also, before we move off from this first one, and I need to point out that tag team match actually is a little bit historical. And in fact, it had the great, even long before Rock and, not Rock, but Stone Cold and Bret Hart, it had the switcheroo of a heel team becoming a face team and a face team becoming a heel team, and the two surviving teams of the Powers of Pain and Demolition. Demolition became faces, and Powers of Pain became heels with the devious Mr. Fuji switching sides. And from there on, they were switch sides.
Yeah. That was actually the 88.
Yeah, I see. I think that was 88 again.
That's the one with the conquistadors.
Oh, yeah,
and
it was. Oh, darn. Well, okay.
You're skipping to the wrong.
Which is fine. Now we've taken care of 88. We can move on.
Okay. Well, then that's fine because I'm going to move. I'm going to just go over here and play with my Red Rooster action figures.
It scares me. He probably has one. No, 88 was kind of a big pay-per-view, though, because that was the Mega Powers in the headliner.
With the Red Rooster as one of the opponents.
With the Red Rooster.
It was also Team DiBiase, technically. It was actually Team Twin Towers, but DiBiase was...
It was Team Red Rooster, but it looked bad on a t-shirt.
Yeah. Poor Haku. Nobody cared about him. But yeah, it was kind of the, like, here's the Mega Powers doing a big deal thing before they collided in, like, 6 weeks after this. So.
Yeah, because this one kind of, like, began to set the stage for them splitting apart.
Yep. That blew up at Royal Rumble, and then by WrestleMania, obviously, was them colliding.
Yeah.
You have to say it like that. It requires it. I think there's a law.
Let me ask you guys that real quick. Okay, so the Survivor Series is the last big WWF event of the year because they have Royal Rumble, then WrestleMania, then SummerSlam. And right. So the road to WrestleMania starts at Royal Rumble. And then the after effect goes to SummerSlam. Where do you find that Survivor Series place in the grand scheme of how things work and the things that they want to do for next year and sort of finish out this year? It is Survivor Series. It would seem to me that would be the place to do it.
Early on, it was, I think, where they finished the feud. This was like the last hurrah. Andre versus Hogan kind of, for example, got its... I think that was its kind of its last kick. I'm trying to think if there was another...
Actually, the exact opposite, because we were still a little bit away from... because you're 1 year before Hogan actually loses the title.
So okay.
It actually kept him alive. In my opinion, it's more of a case of... it's a great question, by the way, because it kind of threw me off. We're not prepared for good questions around here. Listen to the show. You'll know. For me, it always seemed like because at the time there really were only four pay-per-views a year. So you did ramp up to these big moments. And in some ways, this was the capitalization of the fall run of matches. But it also laid a little bit of groundwork as to what we would see come January, which would ultimately lead to what happens in March or April or May or whenever they do WrestleMania that year. So for me, I always thought it was the planting of the seeds for the winter.
And in some ways, the cleaning of the slate?
Yeah, a little bit. In the case of the Mega Powers match that, you know, they had won at SummerSlam earlier that year when Miss Elizabeth took off her dress and shocked the world by showing off her legs. And that tells you how sexy that woman was and just what a different time period it was. That happened. Come Survivor Series, the Mega Powers, best buds, best friends. Hogan wins the match. Elizabeth comes to the ring. He picks her up and hugs her. Savage looks a little angry, but blows it off. It's no big deal. But that planted the seed. Come Royal Rumble, a little bit something happens again. Main event, tag team match. Hogan winds up picking up Miss Elizabeth and carrying her off, leaving Savage to get beaten up by the Twin Towers. And boom, suddenly Savage is irate at Hogan. But it all started back at Survivor Series. So this little things. I think Survivor Series is the nuance pay-per-view. Or at least it was.
Yeah. I think it was a lot of time used to either kind of wrap feuds or build the feuds and hint at the new feuds that were coming. Maybe hint at them more than actually set up what was going to happen at Royal Rumble that would then lead into WrestleMania. I'm looking at 93 right now, where you get the Lex Luger's team versus the All-Americans versus the Foreign Fanatics of Yokozuna coming to mind, where we are setting up what was supposed to be the big WrestleMania 10 match between Luger and Yokozuna that crowned Lex Luger as the new face of WWE. That didn't quite happen. And then at the same time, you had the basically the end of the extended Bret Hart, Jerry the King Lawler feud that inadvertently didn't have Jerry the King Lawler involved in the match because of a criminal charge against him. We would say a criminal charge against him, which worked out for the best because Shawn Michaels was his substitute, and the match was amazing because Shawn Michaels was a substitute. But so you kind of had the end of that feud there. That's kind of the tilt sometimes that Survivor Series would give you, the big match that sometimes would end the feud, sometimes hint at the feud that was coming, and sometimes set up a feud that would go on for a few months to come, depending on how things fall. So.
And that Lawler team versus Bret Hart team was actually very significant because it started the heel turn for Owen Hart.
That it did?
Yeah, because Owen was the only member of his team to be eliminated and felt angry about that.
Also, it involved Greg Valentine dressed up as a knight. Sorry, Greg Valentine.
Yeah, you know. Had Barry Horowitz, too.
Yes. Barry Horowitz makes everything better. Speaking of Barry Horowitz, I want to actually... He's actually involved in one of my favorite Survivor Series matches. Going forward to 1995 and his push, as it was. There were two great matches, actually, that kicked off that Survivor Series. The top half of the Survivor Series was not as good as the bottom half, in my mind. But Horowitz was a member of the Undertogs with Marty Jannetty, Hakushi, and Bob Holly, back when he still had hair. Poor Bob Holly. Right after, I believe this was right about when his spiky plug gimmick had ended. Versus the team of the Body Donnas, Skip and Sonny, Tom Pritchard, who was about a week away from becoming Zip, but was not yet Zip, Rad Radford, who would eventually become Chip. We had this conversation once before. I don't remember, but
Rad Radford was Louis Spicoli.
Louis Spicoli, so. And he became the third Body Donna with another name that rhymed, but I'm not remembering what it is right now. Chip is what comes to mind, and I'm pretty sure that's wrong, because that's a firebreaker, not a Body Donna. And the 1-2-3 Kid made a big heel turn to be the fourth member of that team. Also turned out to be the sole survivor of his team in a really, really good 18-minute match between people who, in modern-day WWE, would never get anywhere close to 18 and a half minutes of ring time ever. So.
Yeah, because even the first pinfall doesn't occur until 5 minutes into the match.
Yeah, it's
which is a lot longer than some of these guys would have wrestled anyway.
Yeah, nowadays you'd be lucky if the Survivor match lasted 5 minutes. But yeah, even with 10 people to be eliminated,
shouldn't Al Snow have been on that team?
Al Snow, I believe, was elsewhere at the time. So
he was 95. He would have been in Smoky Mountain.
He would have been teaming up with Unabomb in Smoky Mountain.
Nothing ever happened with him. I think he went into dental school.
Actually wrested, I believe. He actually wrested on this card later on as a member of the Royal, as Isaac Yankum DDS. So yes,
yes, he did, didn't he?
I remember watching it because I'm watching the Royals come out first when I was watching this pay-per-view again just recently. And I'm like, the Dark Side are their opponents. And I'm like, so Kane is going to fight The Undertaker this match in 1995. So, yeah. Strange happenstance right there. My other favorite women's Survivor Series match also happened in this show, mostly because Aja Kong, who is amazing, and everyone should watch all of her matches all the time, got to be the sole survivor of a team that in modern-day would never, ever, ever happen, as well as Bertha Fay, Tomoka Watanabe, Aja Kong, and Linus Asuka beat Alundra Blaze, who, of course, most people remember better as Medusa, Kyoke Inoue, Sakia Hasegawa, and Chaparita Asari in what is probably the best worked 10-minute match, work rate speed-wise, you will ever see, because they all got something in a 10-minute sprint of a Survivor Series match. Highly recommended. Go check it out on the network. You'll be surprised at how impressive women's wrestling in the 1990s could be. So.
Yeah, that was another boom, and it was a great match. And get to see some of the best going at that time.
There were some great imports in the 1990s from Japan that WWE had for that for their women's division. Sadly, this was a setup for a Alundra Blaze Aja Kong title match that never happened because somebody moved to WCW and threw a title belt into a trash can. So.
Darn you. Darn you, Medusa.
Yep. But, yeah.
Made for good TV.
It did.
Well, in many ways, that...
It would have made for better TV if Aja Kong then came out and backfisted her into... what other Survivor Series matches come to mind for anyone here? Does anyone else have a focus? Do you want to talk about Team Orton versus Team Triple H?
No.
I didn't think so.
sorry. you know, it's funny. You know, the traditional Survivor Series, it was always entertaining. It was a lot of fun to watch. And as I've mentioned even earlier on the show, my favorite Survivor Series, and while everybody talks obviously about the most infamous one being 97, my favorite is 98 with the World Title Tournament, in which, you know, the People's Champion, The Rock, who has suddenly gotten a huge groundswell of fan support, turns in the last match of the night and becomes the corporation's face of the company. It really was a different show, and obviously, you know, as strayed certainly away from the teams of five that strive to survive.
Yes.
But to this day, if it's one of my favorite pay-per-views.
It is a very solid pay-per-view, despite being the only Survivor Series pay-per-view without a traditional Survivor Series match anywhere on the
card. I'm not even sure it's got a tag team match on it,
The New Age Outlaws versus the Triple Threat. D'Lo and Henry, maybe, and someone else.
Jeez.
I'm looking now. Headbangers.
Mosh. Yeah, the Headbangers, D'Lo and Mark Henry, and the New Age Outlaws. Look at that.
Yeah. That was the semi-main event to give us time between that semi-final round tournament and the main event.
And of course, the opening dark match was Brian Christopher and Scott Taylor defeating Matt and Jeff Hardy.
What kind of... Who?
Who?
Were these
it was on Heat. It was a Heat match, and they must have been enhancement talent at the time.
They were definitely enhancements. Of course, the opening match of the card was Mankind versus Dwayne Gill, so make of that what you will.
A phenomenal appearance by Dwayne Gill, too.
I have to say that, okay, so I guess now, since we're talking about the late 90s, it's probably good. So probably, even though I'm... an elder statesman here. My wrestling experience with it is not as deep at all, because I was casual. And then for the 90s, most of the mid 90s, I wasn't aware at all. Let's say it was 97 that I didn't see it, but it made headlines everywhere that pulled me back in. So it's kind of interesting that the attendance goes up for 98, because I think, you know, even though it wasn't an elimination match or what, you know, a standard or what we think of as a Survivor Series traditional match, the events of what happened with Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels was so impactful that I think that and the Rock and the and Mankind, you know, match at 98 too, that's why I'm not surprised to see that that's like the most attended and probably one of the best most watched Survivor Series events that they've ever had.
Well,
at least live.
Yes, at least live. Yeah. And probably a lot more people go back and watch 97 just to see the the Hart Michaels match and the end of it. I mean, we all know how it ends, but.
They should also stay for the Road Warriors, Ahmed Johnson, Ken Shamrock versus the Nation of Domination.
Oh, sure.
Which was a solid tradition of Survivor Series match on that card. I'm sure there were other ones. Yeah, the Truth Commission, in fact, rested on that card. The Truth Commission. But yeah, that definitely, I mean, obviously Shawn Michaels, Bret Hart has been talked about umpteen times here and elsewhere before, and the infamous ending of it. And I think it did set up Survivor Series 98 with the guaranteed crowning of a new champion as being something of importance, and the fact that they kind of built it as, you know, at the time, like, what kind of swerve can top 97's big swerve to end 98?
It was really the beginning of the Attitude Era.
Yep.
A lot of these guys were really being allowed to come out of their shell, and 98 is absolutely the catalyst. You've got the evil Vince McMahon, who is doing everything he can to make sure that Steve Austin doesn't regain the title. But it's a tournament, so he can't keep him out of it. And it's really, I mean, it's soap opera. It's some bad soap opera. But it's there's some good storytelling in there as well. And you've got guys like, you know, the Boss Man, you know, losing his match by disqualification, I believe, by beating up The Rock with the nightstick. So now he's going in to his match against Mankind, and we know he's not 100%. Can he pull it out? And it turns out later on, you know, we discover all along that once again, Vince didn't screw the wrestlers. He swerved us, which was really it made wrestling fun again. For a lot of people.
Yeah, that's the, certainly, you know, that event was huge. Like I said, I heard about it. I dipped my toe back in ever so slowly from 97 on. But I think when I was going back and looking at them, I think the first Survivor Series that I ever, because back then they were a lot more than $9.99. I think the first one I ever watched and said, I'm going to throw down my money and watch this, was in 2001, the one with
the Alliance,
Team WWF versus the Alliance, which to me, like, I mean, that was a heck of a team, a lineup.
Overall, that is a very great card, top to bottom. But I mean, the main event alone, I think it showed how little faith they had in the actual WCW superstars, in the five members of the Alliance that you get, where only Booker T is actually
WCW stuff. Only one from,
With Rob Van Dam, Shane McMahon, Kurt Angle, and Stone Cold Steve Austin as his allies. But you have that team against The Rock, Chris Jericho, The Undertaker, Kane, and Big Show, and they still almost won if Kurt Angle hadn't turned on them and betrayed the Alliance. Which weirdly cements him as a heel coming out of that card, with Stone Cold Steve Austin being a face in one of the weirdest booking things that has ever happened.
That was just a case where the fans just said no.
Yeah. I wanted to cheer Austin so bad, and the whole they had Angle turn at the height of his super popularity to join the Alliance for no reason, and him to become a face again right after that just would not have worked. So what ends up happening is Austin goes face and Angle goes heel. But yeah, it makes a really weird aftermath to a very good 40 something minute long match.
Yeah, 40, almost 45 minutes.
And that debut. And it's a good solid match for 40 minutes. These people go as hard as humanly possible to end this.
But when you, I think if you want to call an all-star card, this is it. I mean, this one, the 87 cards, because it really was a time when everybody on the card was somebody that you wanted to see, and somebody who could put together not just a good match, but a great match. You know, Christian and Al Snow, that right there, you know, some people could laugh at it, but honestly, that's a good match right there. Regal versus Tajiri.
Yeah, two great workers.
Yeah.
I'd watch that.
And then Regal versus Tajiri is another one.
Which didn't go nearly long enough for what it should
have. No, it certainly didn't. But you had the WCW Tag Team Champions, the Dudleys, defeating the WWF Tag Team Champions, the Hardy Boys.
Right.
Which, again,
I mean, that's,
says something
about that's up and down. This is a great card. Yeah, there's no question of that.
Also says something about the lack of faith in WCW again.
And this is when they start unifying the belts, right?
Yeah. All these matches unified the belts. The only weird match in this card that's still... basically, any belt that was unified became the title of the person who unified them, became like the title, so the WWF people won most of them, and we kept those names. The weird thing was the United States champion beat the Intercontinental champion, but we just kept the Intercontinental championship, which still seems odd to this day.
But now both of them are still around anyway.
Well,
so
because we brought back the U.S. Well, we actually retired both belts and have brought back both belts since then. So.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah.
Well, that leads us again, to 2002. Go ahead, Alex.
I was going to mention, just before we go away, it wasn't a tag team competition, but we do have to give a shout-out to the six-pack challenge for the WWF Women's Championship.
That was a very good match.
Featured Trish Stratus, Lita, Jackie, Molly Holly, Ivory, and Jazz. And that, I mean,
wow,
2001, that is great women's wrestling.
That is actually Jazz's WWF debut match, by the way. So
was it really?
Yep. She was the secret sixth member of the alliance third member of the alliance that was taken.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I believe, was the major player for the alliance in that match. It was mostly Trish versus Jazz, and set up a really good feud between those two. So,
and they did great.
Yep.
That was a great boom for female wrestling.
That was Trish's rise to greatness. That was her first title win. That was the beginning of what became Dynasty there.
And nobody knew what Trish was going to become.
No.
From where she was. It was just an amazing transformation.
Well, I remember
she was amazing to watch her grow from actually week to week, because you could see it, you know, in the live shows.
Well, the difference is that despite how she came in, if anybody knows her story, knows that her goal was to be a wrestler. That's what she wanted to be. So her love of wrestling, you know, and that's the key, I think, to where a lot of these guys or girls become, you know, great is how much they really love what they're doing. But now let's go to 2002, next year, and we have the debut of the Elimination Chamber.
Triple
H, Shawn Michaels, Chris Jericho, and Kane versus Rob Van Dam, Booker T, and the first ever Elimination Chamber.
And this was Shawn Michaels' last World Championship. It wasn't a WWE Championship. But yeah, his last Rise to Greatness. Also, weird card because it did not have any traditional Survivor Series match, although it had a six-man tag team elimination match with the Dudleys and Jeff Hardy versus 3 Minute Warning and Rico. But very weird card. Very, very weird card. But yeah, lots of elimination matches. That sort of became their new Survivor thing there. And I think that kind of marks what has happened to Survivor Series in the last 10 years, where the Survivor Series has been downplayed more and more and more and more, where it pops up every once in a while. But, you know, since 2001, this year's main event here in 2014 and I want to say 05, I can't even remember, the Triple H team Triple H versus Team Randy Orton have literally been the only Survivor Series that started to have main evented.
That was 2004.
2004, thank you. So, you know, it's been 10 years.
Well, it's been 9 because the Team SmackDown versus Team Raw.
Oh, I'm sorry, I did forget.
That was 2005, yes. 2005.
Yeah, but again, we're talking 9 years.
Yeah. So
yeah.
So almost a decade, which is actually, in some ways, that can be a good thing, because it gives wrestling fans, it gives older wrestling fans, you know, those of us who have been watching for a while, the chance to go, ooh, they're bringing back this awesome concept of this elimination tag team. And for younger fans, fans that haven't watched all of these things, especially fans that have just gotten into it over the last few years, are going, okay, so they're going to put all these guys in a big dream tag team elimination match. This could be cool. Only problem, of course, being that, you know, as we mentioned earlier,
most of the time
the match will start again.
Yeah, and that's my only thing is that we've discussed something similar like this with the with the Hell in a Cell, where we think it's overused and it needs to be used very carefully and very correctly to blow off feuds or whatever. I think the Survivor Series, as we've indicated, is some of the better matches or ones that really did have a lot of build up to it and had great feuds involved in it, and that they spun off in one direction or another or whatever, and they're more cohesive. I think if they're a little more careful about the booking of it, that the Survivor Series matches could be something that could be looked at as being a little more consistent and good. But I mean, the spectacle of itself is fine, just like the Hell in a Cell. No matter what, when that cell comes down, it's a great moment. But you know, you want to make them the best you possibly can, I would think.
We talked about the importance of what Survivor Series matches means earlier, and I think this is one of those transitional Survivor Series matches where we're building a couple of big new feuds.
True.
While kind of throwing the end of a couple other feuds into there and setting up things to come while ending a couple other things. And because of that, it kind of feels like we've just thrown a bunch of feuds together and put it out there. I think one of the big mistakes coming into that match, too, is the fact that Team Authority, who, you know, you're talking about the bosses, the organization, the fact that Team Authority feels thrown together seems a little odd when you think about the fact that they're the organized side who are running the company, why their team feels as thrown together as it is, as opposed to Team Cena, who, you know, are kind of the, here's the people feuding with all of the people that are on the other side, makes the match feel a little weaker going into it. So.
No. Yeah, well, and that's the thing is, that's just the booking of the day, because, you know, Randy Orton should have been in this match. I think, you know, because they got these guys doing all this other stuff, and then he's taking his time off, then you had to take, you know, somebody had to take his place and all this, that, and the other. So that's just indicative to me today of just the haphazard booking that WWE is too prone to do.
And the fact that there's no, you know, belt at stake. I mean, there's nothing. I mean, Brock Lesnar is nowhere to be seen. I mean, if it was Team Lesnar, you know, that would be, of course, maybe it just be, it would be Brock. Be five guys against Brock.
But well, just, yeah,
the way that they're pushing him, yes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, if we joked about it before we started recording, you know, because we don't have enough tag teams to do what they did back then. But I mean, we've been great to have, you know, the tag team belts defended and something like this.
Well, there's rumors of an elimination tag team match being announced in the near future.
I was going to say, I would find it very surprising if there wasn't a tag team matchup at some sort.
When the main event here has two of the titles sewn up in it, with both the U.S. and IC champion involved, the main title is off the card, and that leaves only the tag and women's belt to be defended. You would think both those belts will be defended on this card.
Yeah. Well, they've announced AJ versus Nikki,
obviously.
So that will obviously be there. But I don't, you know, I would love to see some of the undercard ish talent. I think you could do something really cool. Honestly, in a week's time, you could actually successfully set up a Team NXT versus Team WWF or WWE. Set up with like Adrian Neville, Sami Zayn, and like two other people versus Cesaro and Titus O'Neil and
Tyson Kidd, you know, some other people in that considered
Tyson Kidd, but with sides
of him versus Sami Zayn, Team WWF, but
yeah, and you know, and do something like that where it's, you know, like, you guys think you're the best thing going. We're, you know, we're established. We're stars. Don't think you could come in and take our spot, and really do something kind of cool with that.
Hey, that would, that's
and
a good
you
idea.
Do a Survival Series.
That's a really good idea, and it's another spin on Nexus and the Shield, which were two different things. I mean, Shield and Nexus weren't quite the same, but here you have a whole thing that is just a match where they're showing off their skills, saying, "Hey, we belong on that roster." You know, you guys need to move aside, and they're saying, "Heck no!" You know, you prove it. You know, so
yeah, earn your place.
Yeah, I like that idea a lot.
I think they're making a mistake by not having the New Day debut in time for Survivor Series. I mean, why not put them in a 3-3 elimination match on Survivor Series? The new team of the new team that's finally coming together of Xavier Woods, Kofi Kingston, and Big E. Why not put them 3-3 against another team and show them being dominant in this?
They that'd be fun.
Instead, they're probably going to debut the Raw after Survivor Series, which seems like a weird choice.
So. If they're lucky, they'll get there.
The way the vignettes are coming, that's what my guess would be. But
yeah,
so I think that wraps up our coverage of Survivor Series. We have been quite long in the tooth once again in our discussion of some great matches past and maybe in the future. We'll see in about a week or so. So with that being said, I believe that leaves us just enough time to recommend some stuff to our listeners. So, let's go around the round table one last time and have some recommendations. To start with you, Alex. What do you have to recommend?
Let me see. I already mentioned earlier this week about The Hunger and the Fight from the Mahones, which you should have already gone out and bought. So instead, I will point out just in time for Christmas, one of the best movies of the summer, Guardians of the Galaxy, is coming out. If you haven't seen the movie, shame on you. And what's it like being so alone in the world? Other than that, go buy it. Buy it for people. I'd like mine as a Blu-ray copy, please. Thank you.
Always trying to get free stuff from the fans.
That's all I was saying. Oh, I will mention, I did get to read Mick Foley's Money in the Bank comic book novel. His Pulp Fiction-y kind of...
His first one.
And it's really good. Yeah. I was really very impressed.
I just started the Crisis series that is the current run.
Did you?
It's hilariously awesome. So,
oh, my.
It's basically a Daniel Pryor and Roddy Piper team-up book for the entire first issue, and that's awesome.
Oh, okay. I'm on board with that.
Yeah. John Morgan Neal, what do you have to recommend for us?
What? Huh? What? Huh? Oh, I tell you what, I got a couple of things. Greatest superhero television show of all time, Batman from 1966-67, is finally, after far too long, available on Blu-ray and DVD for your home video purposes. It is great. Wonderful, and I encourage anyone out there to go and buy it because you will be entertained, period. The second thing that I want to recommend is that Aim Geronimo, my character, my web strip has began. It started this last Sunday, and it is a daily strip with a Sunday color. And so if you want to check out some great pulp action adventure with a American Indian female Doc Savage type character, just go to aimgeronimo.com or aimgeronimocomicspage.blogspot.com.tr, or just go to aimgeronimo.com or aimgeronimocomics.tumblr.com, or you can actually, we do post it every day on the ESO network, so go check it out. That's the best thing. Go, you get the best of both worlds. Go to ESO and look for the Aim Geronimo. AimGeronimo.com. Enjoy it.
Oh, we will. We will. Mr. Mike Gordon, what do you have to recommend for us this week?
Last night I checked out a couple of episodes on the El Rey Network of Lucha Underground. Have you guys talked about this?
No, not yet.
No, I haven't.
It is fun. It is a blast. It's really, it's over, almost overproduced, which is kind of interesting, because, Robert Rodriguez is, part of it. I think he's producing it. I don't know how much of an actual hand he has in it, but certainly his minions are at work. Each of the, it's shot in a different style than you're used to. It's almost like he just said, you know, let's shoot a wrestling, like a live wrestling event, even though I know it's not live, but let's shoot it like we were shooting a movie. So there's all these interesting angles that you don't see very often. The clips, you know, the out of the ring clips are all these like really stylized, overproduced, dramatized stuff. But the actual, you know, lucha matches are really fun. A lot of Mexican wrestlers that I'm not personally familiar with, but apparently have a history. Of course, you know, for WWE fans are going to recognize names like Jim Morrison, although he's going by Johnny Mundo now. And Chavo Guerrero Jr. is part of it as well. Other names you, other familiar faces for those people who are familiar with wrestling too, like Conan and Vampiro and, Matt Stryker is actually one of the commentators.
Him and Vampiro, don't let, I believe,
but,
right?
But don't let that stop you. But, it is a lot of fun. I definitely recommend people who have the El Rey Network to check it out. Actually, I found it, in some ways, that hour was a lot more entertaining than some of the hours that I spent watching, you know, WWE and TNT stuff, so, TNA stuff. So, I think it's a new force that's out there, and it's kind of interesting. It's doing exactly what they should be. They're not trying to compete with the WWE. They're giving people something a little different.
Yeah, I heard from Alberto Del Rio's interview on, he's going to be there soon. I mean, not real soon, but eventually.
Oh, I could see that. And I could see Rey Mysterio, of course, you know, making an appearance or two or being part of this as well.
Yep. It's linked with AAA, which is where Alberto Del Rio is working in Mexico now. So there's definitely room for some of them, those big stars, to come in. I think it needs an internet presence with it being on a network.
Right.
Does not have
to let people get. Yeah.
That it needs to be. I can't even watch El Rey. I think if I had DirecTV, I might be able to watch if I had the extended package here. But yeah, it's really hard to get in certain parts of the country, such as
so far
wintry Iowa. So
maybe people should subscribe for $9.99. Is that what you're saying?
If no. only we could, I would be doing that. Speaking of El Rey, I was actually going to recommend a show that they have on Netflix now. So maybe that will be how I will get to watch Lucha Underground eventually, too. We'll see. I wanted to mention the From Dusk Till Dawn TV series, which I started watching on a whim and have been really impressed by how good it is. Basically, it takes the concept of the original From Dusk Till Dawn movie by Robert Rodriguez and Quentin Tarantino and expands that entire movie into an entire season of a TV show with a few added characters, a bunch of added circumstances, and I'm about halfway through the show and we have not even got to the club where the vampires are yet. So, we're almost there. But there's a lot of build around Richie, who is Quentin Tarantino's character in the movie, basically being haunted by the demons that he eventually becomes a member of, going into it with a lot of creepiness going on. Also, Don Johnson is a cast member, despite the fact that he dies on the first episode, as is that 70s show's Wilmer Valderrama in a role that I did not expect I would ever see Fez in, we'll put it that way. So, yeah, definitely an interesting show that I highly recommend everyone go give a chance to on Netflix right now. Or on El Rey, where it will be having a second season soon. What that will be about, I have not a clue. So I believe with that, we have wrapped up another episode of ESO Pro, folks. And that leaves only one thing left to say, I do believe. Mockamania forever.
Woo!
Yep.
Tie tie forever.
Indeed.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at ESONetwork.com.
We reek of one thing, and one thing only. Evil. Evil.